Welcome, everybody. Happy holidays. It's great to see everybody. Really is nice to see everybody. I think first order of business, reviewing the meeting minutes, and hopefully everybody's had an opportunity to read the minutes. I don't know if anybody has some changes they want to offer up for the minutes. If not, I'd ask for a motion to approve the minutes from the last meeting.
I so moved.
I'll second.
Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Okay, the meeting minutes are approved. Next up, Mr. President George Philip.
I will try and go very quickly because since our last meeting, a lot of things have happened on campus. Most recently, we had our winter commencement. 4,100 people attended. We're one of the few schools that still has a winter commencement. 1,100 students graduated, 577 undergraduates, 463 graduates. Senator Schumer appeared as one of our guests, along with Betsy Colbert, who won the honorary degree. All of the speakers were terrific. It was a very well done event at every level, including having things that we managed a tape to send to parents who were in Afghanistan, and a number of other things that we were able to achieve. It was one of the longer events, but it was not long because of the speakers. We had one unexpected speaker, but it was not long because of the speakers. We had a lot of students that came and walked, which is actually a good thing. I'm not going to talk about the Siena basketball game. I'll skip that.
Lee?
I'm not either.
Okay.
I get too. It's too painful to talk about.
We had wonderful coverage in the newspaper. We had that Sunday paper, the Gazette, top of the second half. Led the headline about our graduation.
Oh really?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't read the local newspapers.
So I know that.
It's on tape.
I know that.
It's on tape.
Did a great job.
Let me give you a couple of quick updates on NY SUNY 2020, which is continues to be a hot topic on campus. We are in conversations with SUNY and the governor's office regarding our initiative. We have yet to present to the governor's office. We have had several tentative dates, but all have been rescheduled for one reason or another. None of the U centers have had their plans approved. However, we anticipate that this next week, we anticipate that next week both Buffalo and Stony Brook will have their plans approved at some local ceremony. That leaves Binghamton and the university yet to be approved. We hope that to have a meeting with the governor's staff. To go over any of the remaining issues that attach to our program, and hopefully we'll have news soon that we're scheduled for our presentation and our approval. I'll answer questions at the end if you've got any on that. Trustees approved a 5-year tuition plan, which is pursuant to the new NY SUNY 2020 legislation. The plan itself, and anybody who wants details of the plan, it's available, but the plan calls for up to a $300 a year tuition increase on undergraduate for a 5-year period, which means in the cumulative between now and the end of the period, a $1,500 tuition increase, an average increase of somewhere around 6% a year. The same increase applies to resident graduate students in the master's level, a much more modest and actually realistic increase for doctoral students, because at the end of the day we pay for that anyway, so it's a wash. But it is up to, so the trustees can at any point in time choose to set the rate at a lower level. We hope that's not the case, but they certainly can. SUNY has submitted their budget request to the state. Because of the NY SUNY 2020 and one of the significant elements of that, which is a maintenance of effort, it is the 11-12 state support level for SUNY, which is $822.3 million for the entire SUNY system. a cost to continue, which is steps in longevity increases, as well as general inflation, adding about $7.74 million, an allocation of the final 10% tuition adjustment, which is $16.48 million, and then a sort of a catch-all SUNY Works allocation of $40 million, which brings the total ask to $896.5 million, approximately a $64 million increase from what base support was last year. Again, we're hopeful that this is the plan that's adopted. The good news is that we don't anticipate a cut. And of course, as you know, in the past years, we've had significant cuts. Other SUNY news, the governor and SUNY have worked out a plan that will impact our MC employees, that's management confidential employees, on campus. They will now be subject to the 9 days of deficit reduction leave, which is the furlough, which for the current fiscal year amounts to about a 4% salary, a little over 4% salary reduction for the year. For the next year, it's approximately a 2% salary reduction under phase two. It's very difficult because our employees do not get, our MC employees do not get step and longevity increases like other states, other state employees do. So this is a real cut in terms of their benefits. This is the same group, incidentally, that hasn't had a raise in 4 years at all. We haven't given them a dime, unlike the represented unionized group on campus who have received increases. So this is a difficult pill to swallow. There is an element to the furlough is that in 2015 there will be a recovery of the deferred amounts, but it's sort of adding to what is a difficult circumstance relative to the income for and that's not just senior management, it's senior management. There's 68 people or 70 people that are affected, and some are at the lower levels, and that's even more difficult. I won't get into a whole lot of details. Another one, Carl Hayden, who had been the chairman of the SUNY Board of Trustees, announces retirement 2 days ago. 2 days ago, he had been replaced as chairman of the SUNY Board of Trustees by Carl McCall probably a week or so ago. I think Carl Hayden did a great job, and his resignation is effective December 31st. And not only did he do a good job with the Board of Trustees, he also led the New York State Board of Regents for a number of years and did a great job there. So he's a talented guy that will be missed in that arena. Yesterday we had a rather elaborate ceremony downtown and where the governor announced the REDC winners, Regional Economic Development Council winners. As all of you know, there were 10 areas designated in the state, zones. We were the Capital Region Economic Development Council here, but they took the 64 counties and divided it up into 10 and had some interesting map appearances. It looked like a gerrymandered environment, but four of the areas won special attention. They were Western New York, Central New York, the northern tier of whatever it's called, the
North Country,
and Long Island, that won the special designation. The university, I participated in our regional council. The university submitted a number of requests, CFAs, and we were very successful in that. We did not submit anything at on a big level. We didn't throw in big money requests because, frankly, we have been on the receiving end of a lot of big money for a long period of time, especially in terms of capital. But the region won $62 million in the competition. We won $2 million for our R&A Institute, which was well deserved. Another, which was incidentally the number two ranked proposal. The number three ranked proposal was our proposal for expanding our cancer research facilities in order to accommodate a partnership with Trudeau from Saranac Lake. That we asked for two, and we got $1 million there. In addition, there is a research alliance between the University, Albany Med, and RPI that was funded at $950,000. In the central, is it central?
Mohawk.
The Mohawk Valley region. There was a $15 million grant, frankly, that was very largely due to our nano participation at SUNY IT.
Right.
So it was really our efforts that had a good deal to do with that award in the Mohawk Valley area. Other good news, one of our professors, I knew that if I bridge it up, I have to remember it. Strakowitz?
Strakowski,
all right. There's all kinds of letters in this thing. And his team were awarded an $8.7 million four-year federal grant funded by the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. And the purpose of the grant funding will go to develop a video game aimed at training adults to overcome bias in critical decision-making. These biases can lead to bad decisions in critical matters, including national security. It's a very interesting project. It's very exciting. It's cutting edge. And obviously, very important because $8.7 million is not a small amount of money for a federal grant. We were one of five organizations in the state to be named as to receive the 8th Annual State Environmental Excellence Awards, which is a very good thing. We have reduced our energy use over the past 3 years. The cutbacks are enough to basically power 500 average homes for a year. So we've done a good job in terms of reducing our carbon footprint, also our production of greenhouse gases. We've slashed our electrical bill by about $700,000 a year, which is helpful in an environment of austerity. And we have had a very good program in place, not only educating students and staff and faculty on conserving energy, but making sure that all of us understood that it's going to be quite a bit colder in the winter and quite a bit warmer in the summer. Dan was smart enough to wear his fleece to participate in the meeting. Our temperature reduction times are starting Saturday of this week. Next week, Saturday of next week, we are going down to about a 63-degree setting in all the buildings, and then we are going during the business hours. That's phase one. That only goes to December 22nd. Phase two goes to 55 degrees from December 22nd through January 12th, or through December 22nd to January 3rd. Then we go back to phase one.
Do you have plants and stuff that can survive?
We actually, the plants can survive. We've done that.
Stop it where it's a little bit warmer when it's colder as opposed to being colder when it's warm?
This is the way we save money. But
I'm just asking.
Yeah, but we have alternative work sites for that are available because we have a lot of operations that require, for example, processing admission applications. We have an alternative work site for that. The library is also available as an alternative work site for those people who want to use them. And for those where there are experiments going on and research that's going on that requires, additional accommodations, we're certainly making it. But clearly what we've gotten is a society here on campus that understands the need to conserve, and we have a terrific young lady that has managed all of our efforts, and she has done a great job over the years. So she's really the person. And what is Malia's first name? Mary Ellen Malia, and she's done a terrific job. We had the president of the Federal Reserve Bank on campus for our third annual Business Leaders Breakfast. He did a great job. It was very interesting trying to accommodate the security. Apparently the president of the New York Fed Bank is at risk because he had extensive security as part of his process, but he did a good job, and our students excelled. I was I was in awe of the questions that the students asked. I came back the next day, or that happened to be the day that I announced that I was going to retire, and I was really convinced that we had done a good job setting up the students, and we had not. The questions they asked were their questions. They were not planted. They were fabulous. Citizen Laureate event went very well. Well attended, 340 people, a good field of candidates. Our efforts on the development side continue to increase and do well. Fardeen has done a great job, including getting a $1 million anonymous gift to athletic improvements and a number of other endowed scholarship grants that add up to a considerable amount of money. Since 2008, our endowment has increased by 26%. So that's pretty good in this economic environment, and it's a tribute to the Advancement Office for doing a lot of good work. I think I'm going to stop there because I still have pages of activities, but I'll be happy to. I have one I have to do. I have to congratulate a member here. Lee McElroy has been inducted into the Hall of Fame, the McClendon Administrators Hall of Fame, which is a very prestigious national award for athletic directors and people who are involved with athletics of color. And Lee. And I'll take any questions. No questions. Yes.
Any update on the management study?
Yeah, the management study is, they have finished the survey. Steve, they finished the survey. They have gotten a lot of the raw data that they need to finish their report. And Steve, since Steve's coordinating it, I'll let him answer.
Yeah, we did a campus-wide survey. Got a lot of responses, over 600 or 700, maybe just shy of 700. Not everybody responded to every question. Remarkable, actually, for a sample of size as large as ours. Took a look at the raw data, and it's not very, I just mentioned to the president this morning, it's not very instructive. We would ask questions like, do you believe that counsel's office is properly situated in the president's office? 350 people said yes, 350 people said I don't know, and nobody else said anything. There are alpha fields, though, where folks were asked to comment up and down the line. That we haven't seen yet, and it's promised to us next week. So it's still very raw, but I think we're coming into the home stretch on it, so we ought to have something to report in the spring for sure.
And everybody's been interviewed?
Everybody's been interviewed, although they may be back to drill down,
yeah,
depending on what the data shows and what we'd like them to do.
And it's not been orchestrated by me. I have actually had very little involvement with the process because that at least attaches some credibility to it if I'm not involved.
So. George fills out all the alpha boxes.
Yeah.
George, I haven't been up in the university on the grounds for a bit, and I see the business school looks like they're going
incredible,
crazy. Any just update? And
It is on schedule, if not a little ahead of schedule. They have done a terrific job in terms of trying to get the at least the roof buttoned up. They're sealing the sides, if you notice right now, because they intend to do a good deal of work obviously working in the winter. I think it's a well-designed, well-constructed facility that is, it's one of the better, and I've participated, I've been at work sites in the past, it's one of the better work sites I've ever witnessed, and that's unusual for a public project. Done a really good job. And this is not only the dormitories that are on the southeast side of the campus are proceeding apace, and they will be open in August for next year's incoming class.
Wow.
Which is important. We are in the stages right now of programming for the campus center improvements. with the most recent legislation, we'll probably be able to start moving at pace in that arena. And as importantly, and Lee wants to make sure I say this, we're very hopeful to be able to get started with our athletic facility improvements in the very near future. So all that will be on the way.
Those dorms initially are going to be shutting down dorms for reconditioning?
The 500 beds there will enable us to take a few more beds offline for rehab, and ultimately Mohawk Tower, which is in Indian Quad.
Yeah.
That's the next fall. That's coming up.
next fall, that's coming offline, and interestingly enough, that's the newest tower.
Yeah.
Just the poorest, the worst built
that makes
tower
sense
of them.
Any other questions for George? Thank you, George. Tremaine.
Hello, it's good to see everyone again. Just a couple of quick things. Our Student Government Association had a very strong first semester this year. We had a lot of good things going on. You know, our block party back in the beginning of the semester, despite being pushed off due to hurricane, was probably one of the best we had in at least the past 4 years or so. Speaker series, Magic Johnson, if any of you guys attended, went very well. And I heard a lot of positive things from students, parents, faculty members, staff, everyone who attended. And it was definitely one of the best ones we've had, obviously, next to President Clinton being here. But President Clinton is President Clinton. Mr. Johnson definitely had probably one of the best messages to our students next to General Powell. So it was definitely very well received. October, the Community Service Month, went very well. We had a lot of community service activities from our students. So, you know, we had a lot of students out there into the community, which went over very well. I know our students took a trip to Binghamton at the end of October to help with the cleanup there.
Several trips to Schoharie County.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so a lot of trips to that area to help clean up that region. Unfortunately, during one of our last trips, our students did have the pleasure to work with the student government advisor from Cortland, who unfortunately passed away in an accident on his way back from that trip. But our student government did send condolences to Cortland students and whatnot. And what my understanding is, all the students that met him said he was a great person and was a great help during the cleanup efforts. Our fall concert, which we just had this past November with LMFAO and Far East Movements, was probably one of the best. And President Philip is laughing.
Sure,
here,
no,
I'm sure he knows. I have no idea what we're talking about.
I had never ever heard of. Is that two people? Was that two groups?
Chris knows about LMFAO. But it was definitely we had about 3,200 students in attendance. Which was probably one of the best. We normally don't break. We normally get somewhere between 2,000 and 2,500 students, so that's probably one of the best concerts in terms of attendance that we've had, and also in terms of incidents at concerts, because we are students. It was probably one of the lowest number of incidents we've had. So definitely good there. In addition to that, our Student Senate has also been fairly active this year. They've also been doing a lot in the community. They've been involved with the Pine Hills Neighborhood Association, so they've been going to those meetings, a lot of our students, and getting involved down there. They did a fundraiser not too long, last couple Mondays ago at TGI Fridays. So basically anyone that went to Fridays that day and spent $20, for every $20 you spent, $5 went to some charity that was getting toys for children, and they raised over $100 during that fundraiser, so they did that. The other thing, a less positive note, our students this past year, the previous year when NY SUNY 2020 came up, had been in support of it. This current Student Senate passed a resolution at the beginning of the semester changing that position to opposition for NY SUNY 2020. However, student support in general does seem to be fairly mixed on the issue. We obviously do have Save Our SUNY and the New York Students Rising groups, but student support in general seems to be pretty mixed. And lastly, just a note on our student association itself, we did have in the past couple weeks an issue come up with the student government's finances. We did discover that there was not an issue after all. However, ourselves along with staff from Student Success and Finance and Business are going to be taking a closer look at our student government's operations, because what we're realizing is there are a lot of perpetual problems that continually come up and just have not been addressed. And fortunately, or maybe unfortunately for me, I just happened to be the comptroller for the student government this year, so I think everyone is just kind of taking the advantage of the fact that I am someone who knows what I'm doing with the organization. So we're trying to do what we can to find ways to, you know, work on some of these issues and, you know, correcting them for the future sustainability of our, you know, our Student Government Association, to make sure, you know, our student activities and whatnot can continue at the level that they do on campus.
You raised it. Can you, like, what happened?
Essentially what happened is, by SUNY guidelines, we have, you know, certain guidelines that we have to follow it for student activity fee funds. And one of them is that we're required to have a certain amount of reserve funds, which I believe SUNY sets it at about 5% reserves of our total annual budget collected from student activity fees. Despite this policy, I don't think it's really ever been enforced heavily over the years, because we basically have just always anticipated that we're going to have a certain level reserve, because
just like every corporate that America that blows their bond covenants,
we either always have funds from either shooting funds that don't get used or revenue that comes in. So I think no one's ever thought about it, but because of some new programming that we put on the past couple of years, speaker series now, President Clinton last year. So with all these different things that have come up that have not necessarily been expected expenditures, we've expended a little more than we've anticipated.
But you got a process, you're working through it. So
yes.
Is there an audit for Maine?
Yes, we do. We are required by SUNY to have an audit every year. Audit was actually just, we just have our audit presentation this past Wednesday, and that is due to be completed in the next couple weeks or so, I think.
Just a question on the opposition to 2020. Was that based on the tuition increase? Is that
primarily?
And that was our student senate here, or SUNY wide?
It was SUNY wide, but still in support.
It's still,
but that was our student senate here switched their position on the bill.
We actually presented Wednesday.
Presented Wednesday night on NY SUNY. We got a pretty warm welcome from some of our Save Our SUNY students.
Warm is an operative word.
Yeah.
Does that mean heated?
Heated is warm.
But yeah, so we did have that presentation. So like I said, student support in general seems to be mixed on supporting or unsupporting. I think a lot of students do understand that with the economic times that they are, and the way that the state has systematically been cutting from the SUNY system, I think a lot of students pretty much understand that it's just a reality that, and they'd much rather have to know that there's going to be a certain set level of an increase potentially versus just randomly getting a massive hike 1 year. So
right. Does that sort of that concern go deeper and go to things like maintenance of effort, or is it really just a visceral reaction to the tuition increase?
I think primarily it's just a reaction to the fact that you're making them pay more money. Some of the more well-informed students may have a more in-depth opinion on things, and I think a lot of students just, despite our efforts to inform them, just remain, to a degree, uninformed.
I think one of the operative things is that we are actually, tuition increases are no higher than they've been over the past 20 years.
Right.
The difference being that they've been large increases at any point in time, and all of those increases have gone to fund some hole in the state budget. So at the end of the day, not a penny has actually been used on behalf of the students. This, with the maintenance of effort concept, allows us to take whatever tuition increase occurs between now through this five-year period and use it on campus for the benefit of the students. Huge difference, and really about the same average increase that's occurred over the past 20 years. It's just, if you happen to be in the position where you didn't get one in your four-year period, or if you happen to be in a position where you got slammed, it's different. But I think that's the misconception that goes on, that this is extraordinary and different. It is different because we actually get to use the money to benefit the students.
It's different constructively, and that's why I asked the maintenance of effort.
Yeah, I think there's just a fear that despite the efforts that SUNY and our campus have been making to make sure that the funds always go back to the students that are paying for their education, right. It's just the fear that what's going to stop the government from just pulling it back again. Yeah. So.
It's still a bargain.
The TAP award's gone up proportionately.
No, yeah. We've actually the TAP awards. The cap is still at 5,000, I believe. And the what we've done is we've set aside almost 30% of the tuition increase to be allocated
for scholarship.
Allocated to those people who are in prorated on the basis of their TAP eligibility. So if you're eligible for 100% TAP, you'll basically be held harmless by the money that we put aside.
Did we publicize that?
We have, but it's something that that sometimes falls on deaf ears. But I'm not sure, was that part of the presentation, the allocation of about 30% of the pot?
I think so. I'm pretty sure.
And that's something that should resonate, because we are very mindful of the need to sustain access to the university, access especially among the neediest of our students. So that was our way of making those students, preserving that access to our students, while we're trying to at least convince people to increase the TAP. The problem is that the vast majority of TAP aid goes to private schools.
Yeah.
We get a very small portion of the total TAP pool, and most people think that TAP is for the state university.
Right.
It's not. It's for all colleges, and the private. I think the private schools get 70%. It's a big number.
I think that message about how we're making sure that the people who need access are getting access is the most important reaction or way to combat this opposition, because people are always going to oppose an increase in fees because it's a knee-jerk reaction.
These points are all online on our website, right?
I believe so.
Yeah. Any other questions for Tremaine?
Trey, can you talk about the future of the speaker series?
Future? it will certainly continue. I think one of the things that we are looking into currently is finding ways to make it sustainable into the future. Because, like I said, the cost is high, and nothing's getting cheaper these days. So I think the future is finding ways to continue to make it sustainable. And I think what is probably going to end up happening in the long term is that we'll probably stick to doing one main speaker in the fall, at homecoming time, because logistically speaking, it's just easier for us to do, because you're homecoming, you're always going to have people here on campus, and you always have the time for it. So logistically speaking, it'll probably, become a homecoming thing, and we're looking into ways to find other sources, alternative sources of funding outside of our
if I may, Trey, we have been working in my office with the Student Association in possible key sponsors.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I shouldn't say key sponsor for the program. See if there's one or two for naming. I think after this year, our students really prove to the community and in the corporate community this is definitely worth lending their name to. Mm-hmm. And so we have the credibility now to attract a major sponsor for this.
Makes sense. Thank you, Ferdy. Thanks, Tremaine. Andy?
Good afternoon. As the faculty representative, probably no surprise that top on our hit parade of concerns is the fact that our beloved president has announced his retirement, and obviously dealing
with... She said that with a straight face.
The beloved part. Straight face. I just want to point out.
She's in theater, George.
Yeah, but I'm the other end.
I know.
But obviously, the faculty are concerned about having a voice and working with all of the various constituencies to make sure that we get someone who has some very big shoes to fill. And that's obviously our biggest concern. A few other things I'll mention that might be of interest to you. Back during the Middle States review, there was a note in there that it pointed to a need for a more systematic administrative review. As a result of that, last year the University Senate charged the SEC, which then turned to the Governance Council, to come up with a process for that systematic assessment for administrators and administrative units. At this point, we're working very much in a model to have this be something that is helpful, that it is not punitive, it is not intended to cause trouble or difficulties or make people nervous, but designed over the long haul that it will actually improve things on campus for everyone. Right now we're looking at a 5-year timeline of rotation, and at this point the Senate Council that's charged with this has decided that the best way to make sure that this actually happens and that there will be institutional memory is to put forth a charter amendment to make a separate council of the University Senate that will be charged with this. And the proposed acronym is CARE. So, So that is moving forward.
That's not trademarked by somebody?
It probably is, but... so that's moving forward. The General Education Committee is still working very hard, and they are very close, we understand, to coming up with a manageable a proposal that is also maintains academic integrity, and we hope that we will be seeing that in the spring. And obviously, that affects our future in terms of bringing in students to the campus at the undergraduate level. And the one other thing I'll mention is that one of the councils has also begun forums on going tobacco-free, and I suspect someone else in this room will talk more about that. But they've begun to talk about those, the pros, and if there are any cons, of going, making this a smoke-free campus. Okay. The highlights.
Any questions for Andy? Okay, thank you very much, Andy. Nick, are you still on the line? You know what? No, Nick. Hey, Nick. No, we can't. Can you just go back to mute?
I submitted a written report, so let me know if you have any questions.
All right. Thanks, Nick. I think Nick provided an update from the graduate student representative. So obviously, if you haven't read it, read it. If there are other questions for Nick, he's always reachable by email. But I think given his location, and by the way, he is not here because he's doing something. In pursuit of his degree here. So I think that's important to note. Okay.
Thank you. Well, I'm fresh off my second board meeting, so I wanted so anxious to share with you the good work of the group. By the way, I've been asked, how many do we have on the board? We have, we have 32 members. Actually, we have 32 are board members, and then six officers. So we have a total of 38. Wonderful, wonderful people. Now, what you have before you is the work of Saturday, primarily all day. We, as you know, we're embarked on our Vision 2014 strategic plan. And in my seminary training, we're taught to preach, teach, and care for people, heal people. I embraced preaching a little too much, I have to say. So therefore, George is laughing. He needed to take a bottle of Pepto-Bismol after my last graduation speech in the rain.
This one was great. Most recent.
There we go. But at any rate, he always equipped me with a script, so I will stick to the script. You know what? Let me just one other observation. I noticed when I became president, whenever they used to send another president out, they always hand them a script. Then they would simply say, wishes, users, suggested notes. Me? Stick to the script, okay? Stick to the script. So here I am, sticking to the script. On your first point under strategic plan, we really have infused the entire process with four aspects of measurement, priorities, communications, and marketing to engage students and alumni. We have four subcommittees that are working on each of those, all towards our 2014 vision. Under the page two, the University Career Advisory Network, now we are well aware that there's wonderful work being done by many mentors on this campus. Certainly Chris's shop does that, a lot of that, and Lee, I know, in the athletic department. But this is strictly geared to the alumni. So our goal is to recruit 1,200 alumni mentors by February 15th. Then we're going to, from about mid-February to early March, we're going to promote these mentors to the students. And how we're going to do this is through email, social media, academic advisors, key faculty, student groups, career services, and residents alike. Okay, regional plan. We've divided our state up into 10 regional areas, as well as throughout the United States. And so what we're going to do is we are collecting and currently analyzing. In fact, it's almost done. We worked on this Saturday. Of analyzing our alumni by region with the goal that we are going to create a tier system and based on participation, non-participation, donors, non-donors, and so on. By January 30th, we will determine the number of annual events that the staff and the board are going to offer annually. These are full-fledged big events. The tier one, of course, will be our own region, and where we have most alumni, but we'll also be in other cities such as Boston emerges, of course, New York City, Washington, D.C., and so on. What will happen in these regions initially going to be 3 to 4 major events a year. In Tier 2 will be 1 to 2 events a year, and then in Tier 3 an event every other year. under social media, this is where I glaze over. Our next phase will be to have alumni who are already plugged in. We'll do a series of email blasts with a drive to Facebook to call to action, invite them to participate in a conversational poll, quiz, or contest. Software, hardware, and applications. I have to. They escape me. And anyway, and then finally, under engagement, we've been asked, well, why all this measurement? In fact, our own board said, why all this measurement and so forth? Well, the primary purpose is to determine, once we offer these programs, who attended, are these programs really successful, and so forth, in an effort to use our resources wisely, but also to increase the level of alumni participation. And I must say that I can't thank enough Fardeen's operation and his folks in the development division, because they have helped us with a lot of the data, a lot of analyzing, and so on. So that is my report. I stuck to the script. Any questions, comments? Yes.
I just received a message, I think from Bill McCann, talking about candidates to go on the board of the alumni board. Are there a number of positions that are open, or?
Question, yeah, haven't you asked me that. Yeah, we have nine positions available. Seven of the nine are the incumbents, so they've been asked to fill out a questionnaire to determine what they've done in the past and what they propose to do. And then we have two vacancies. So actually, we may have as many as nine, but we probably will only have seven. It's going to be my best guess. But thank you for raising that. I encourage you to please give us some nominees. It's an exciting board. I mean, they're representative all over the United States. We have California, Texas, Florida, all over. In fact, we even had a report from China, our treasurer. Mm-hmm. And, of course, you can call in, so it's not a matter of that you have to travel here. We meet four times a year as a full board, and then most of the work is done by committee work. It's exciting. It's a fun thing to do. Thank you for raising that.
Okay. Anyone else? Great, wonderful. I don't have any old business. I don't know if anybody has old business and want to bring up to the council. Okay. New business, we have from the University Council's office here today, Janet Thayer. Thank you, Janet.
Thank you. I'm Janet Thayer from the University Council's office. The university has found itself in a position where it needed to address the needs of third parties coming on the university campus to exercise his or her free speech rights. The rules for the maintenance of public order, Board of Trustees policy, does have a carve out for each campus to develop its own policy. Recently, the university has looked at that policy and realized that we really should be using more than our use of facilities policy for these third-party speakers. The university, as I put in my memo, and I understand that Sorrell has shared with all of you, we only have about 2 to 3 requests every academic year for these third parties. These are not folks who are invited by the Student Association, by the Alumni Association, by any other campus organization, either to teach a class, to be a presenter, to speak at graduation, etc. This is just third parties who want to come on campus. We are a public entity, and therefore we have to guarantee their free speech rights. Unfortunately, free speech can be a challenge, and we often don't think about positive messages that we personally and professionally find positive as free speech. It's usually the offensive message that is the one where we say, oh yes, you do have a right to say that, and I have a right to walk away. Unfortunately for our campus, the free speech that we often hear, and I don't mean to offend anyone, but I'm going to cut right to the chase, is from three different groups, Reverend Greg DeFario, Jim DeFario, excuse me, Bible Greg, and the Westboro Baptist Church, which, as you may recall, that's the church that protests at military funerals. And the very prevalent message is an anti-gay message, starting with God hates fags, and goes from there. Our students have had a very hard time with that message, so have alum, faculty, and staff, but it is the First Amendment right. And again, we could all be standing out there saying, isn't winter great? And, you know, that's still our First Amendment right, so no matter what the message is, content neutral. So when we develop this policy, we're really trying to balance, as a governmental entity, the rights that we have to guarantee for any speaker who comes on campus, third party, as well as the student, parents, alumni, faculty, staff concerns. about the use of our facilities. Also using it as an educational opportunity about the First Amendment and when it really does cut right to the heart of the matter. Also having a safe community. I'll be perfectly honest with you, Reverend Jim DeFario, who has sued us, he is infamous on the internet with videos about protests that he has done at Purchase and at New Paltz. He loves to have bottles thrown at him. He loves to be punched in the face, etc., because it's all about the arrest. But we want a safe campus, and also managing campus resources, because as our U.S. Supreme Court has said, we cannot charge people to come here to use our facilities, indoors or outdoors, for free speech. Again, third parties only. We cannot charge them for insurance requirements. We cannot charge them application fees. In fact, the only thing we can have charge associated with is parking, because we charge everybody parking. So that's the only thing we can charge for. So it's a tax on campus resources for, even the use of this room today. The lights are on, the heat is on, et cetera. And also for these third parties, it could be a tax on the police as well as other administrators, et cetera. So it's trying to balance all of that. What this policy reflects is exactly what the Supreme Court of the United States says we have to give third parties. On the flip side, when our students come concerned, or actually in support, it's an opportunity for us to say, this is what we have to allow them to do. This is what you can do. You can participate. You can walk away. You can invite other speakers on campus, or you can be a speaker yourself. Invite either through the Student Association or other faculty, staff, university resources. I know you've all had an opportunity to read it. I don't know, does anyone have any questions?
Just a generic one, and then mm-hmm. I looked at it quickly, sorry, forgive me, but time, place, and manner is,
right.
Biggest hole, and people make millions, lawyers do anyway, trying to interpret what that means. But so just in layman speak, are we allowed to say to them, you want to come to campus, it's fine. We understand what the content is, what they want to talk about, and can we say you can have your speech in the middle of the circle at right. any time? Can we do something like that?
Right. What the university has done, and because this is the traditional form that we've allowed people to be in, is we designated the outdoor space directly in front of the campus center from approximately that internal fountain, right. the smaller fountain,
sorry.
All the way out to the larger fountain. The larger fountain obviously is in the drop-off, the pit there. We allow that area. First of all, it's the most highly trafficked area probably on campus for pretty much anyone who goes to school here or works here. So we can't say, again, whether you're Mother Teresa, you're Eric Clapton, or you're Reverend DeFario, you can't say you don't have an audience. It's also outdoors, so we're not using indoor resources. There's no requirement we use an indoor resource, and those are very valuable resources, as you well know. Third, it is away from actually interrupting the educational mission. So for the most part, it's away from classrooms, and it's also not interrupting necessarily the general administration of the university. So it's not sitting outside the president's office or, Steve Bennett's office as a finance officer or something like that. So it's
are they allowed to use amplified sound, or we restrict that?
In ours, what we do is, because we require any speaker who comes on campus to use the university sound system, if you want it, you need to put that in your application, and we'll provide the sound system. It's not even so much in terms of volume, but we do not allow bullhorns, because that becomes very distorted and can echo given the fountains. It's an you can have an amplified system, but it's an amplified system suited for the buildings, etc. For the best hearing of the message, but also for the least amount of disruption to anyone who either wants to walk away or in classes or, the library, etc.
Thank you.
I'm curious how the insurance works. I mean, I thought it was kind of practical to require the person to have insurance, and now we have to cover them, and particularly if someone's provoking a situation that might require medical attention or...
Correct. Typically, if someone wants to come mm-hmm. here to use a facility, and the Student Association has their own insurance also for this purpose, we require a commercial insurance policy to cover the event. And I'm sure we've all been involved in procuring those. right now the insurance is really the New York State's self-retention. So if anything happens here on campus and we are sued, we would look to the Court of Claims, if we're sued in the Court of Claims as the state of New York, to cover whatever those damages are. Or if you're a state employee and sued in your official capacity, it would be the Public Officer Section 17 Fund that would cover. The New York State Attorney General would be the defense counsel.
So if this fellow's, for example, punched mm-hmm. in the face and loses mm-hmm. a few teeth, how?
And he sues us?
He would just use his own, and then he'd sue right. us to get exactly. reimbursed for someone exactly. doing that to him on our exactly. property.
Yes. And honestly, in my opinion, legal opinion, he uses the Alliance Defense Fund. It has a website. It's an interesting website to look at. He uses lawsuits to really generate the legal fees to continue the legal representation. And the lawsuits are one way of getting out the message.
We were sued. We actually
yeah.
we
yeah,
adhered to we it. Adhered to the rules that were in place at the time. This most recent Supreme Court decision has changed the game.
Right. And we were actually, just to be very clear, we were already working on the policy, and in fact it was really done, and we were just needed to vet it with a few other folks, because some of the parts of the policy are hard to swallow. Again, whether you're Mother Teresa or, you know, Reverend Fario, that you can come and use the campus without reversing for any costs associated with that. But we were really pretty much there. And I will tell you, in August, we appeared before and we were...
Nick, mute your phone again.
We were very happy when we presented to the judge our draft policy. With all of you...
Who else is on the line, so sorry,
Nick and Jim.
I think it's Nick.
It's only the two. Jim, are you still on the phone? Jim?
Yes, I am.
Jim, you are. Nick.
Hey, Nick.
Nick, can you hear us? Nick?
Exactly.
Actually, Nick. Don't speak
it.
Yeah, you have interference again, Nick. Can you make sure your phone's muted?
Yeah, I'm sorry about that.
Thank you.
We're very happy because when we appeared before the judge, we presented the policy with all the appropriate caveats, of course, that the council has to approve this, but this is what the university is working towards administratively. The judge was very pleased with it, and actually the Alliance Defense Fund was willing to accept it in settlement of the lawsuit. And I believe I mentioned in my memo to Sorrell that the real issue outstanding right now in the lawsuit are legal fees for the motion for a preliminary injunction. And the Attorney General, you know, it's public coffers, doesn't want to pay anything more than what a judge would order. So when it comes to reasonable attorney's fees and negotiating that, you're always on the defense side negotiating against yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So, and actually, depending on the action the council takes today, we'll be notifying the judge no matter what the outcome of today. And we are hoping to accelerate the resolution of the case.
What if somebody says, I don't want to be uptown, I want to be up in downtown?
We do have a right to time, place, and manner. As long as it's content neutral, it's applied to everyone. And again, we're not charging fees. We are not being unreasonable, saying, well, you can speak between, you know, 5 a.m. and 6 a.m. We're giving a reasonable audience. So we are able to do that. And so far, the downtown campus, and a lot of thought really did go into this in analysis, the student body. The downtown campus doesn't have the student faculty staff flow that the campus here does. Again, we pick the outside of the campus center because that is where you're going to get the largest amount of traffic. That's where students typically go for table reservations, etc., for any time they're advertising their student events or their groups and membership and all of that. So we were trying to be. It's not like we said you have to go back by the old oak tree that no one doesn't even know, you know, we have no idea even where that is. You know, good luck drawing an audience.
My only concern there is if the, especially by the campus center, it's a highly trafficked, fairly confined area that probably is if there's going to be a problem with great congestion and injury, that's where it would be. And I have real concerns about that portion. I don't mind the portion on the other side of the fountain, which is the open area that goes in, because it's not as confined. Even though it's trafficked, it's not as heavily trafficked as the other area.
We can designate another spot on the podium.
Well, actually, the question I was going to say, does this document encourage council and president of the office to have flexibility to change if certain circumstances arise, like George said? Now, it would have to probably be for everyone to be consistent, but do you have flexibility in this document?
Or
do you have to come back to us every time to do it?
We could make the flexibility for the president to be able to change and designate a forum spot in light of emergency
situations. The health, safety, and welfare.
How many people can you accommodate? So, I mean, that was my question. And that space that you've identified outside the campus center between the fountains, do you have a sense of what you're...
According to UPD, we can accommodate up to almost 200 people. In the past, what has really happened in the past is when the three groups have come, UPD is notified, and a UPD officer or two comes for crowd control, not to intimidate, but crowd control. And typically, Chris Bouchard's office, several people will come and show up, and John Murphy in particular has been helpful in educating the students about, you have many rights here yourself. You can ask questions, you can speak yourself with your own mind, you can walk away. But violence is not a great response, et cetera, et cetera. So we on our campus actually have not had the problems that New Paltz and Purchase have had.
So if there's a provision put in with a health, safety, and welfare clause or standard to allow the president to change the venue, that would be acceptable to judge?
Yes.
Because you could conceivably have a group that's going to draw a lot more than 200. I mean, in some circumstance, maybe not this circumstance.
Right. But conceivably, yes.
Yeah.
We could.
Okay. Well, does the council want to have that as a proviso added to the document?
I think that's a good idea.
Janet, we can do that?
Yes.
Okay. Janet, just one question. Is that not going to mess up your discussions with council and judge and stuff?
No.
And so ordering everything?
No. That was not a primary concern.
Okay. Fair enough.
Really is a function of the size. We've had, I've been protested in that venue in the past for programmatic cuts, and that it's worked very well in terms of the... I actually attended my own protest.
We protest you here.
Did you burn yourself in effigy, George?
No, I actually, I think people were surprised I was there. But it's really a matter of numbers. I don't think anything that these guys would have created, they would not have generated a whole lot of numbers. My concern is if there's a counter demonstration that happens to come up.
Right.
And then you've got two groups in the same confined area that are not particularly friendly with each other. The possibility of a problem exists, and that's the part that concerns me.
Yes. We can easily draft that.
Okay. Okay, so with that change made to the policy, can I get a motion to approve the resolution?
Wait. Who moved it?
I'll move it.
John's sleeping, so he and I usually fight.
All in favor?
Aye.
Janet, can I just ask that that you just update the council, on the progress? I don't think we have a next formal meeting, perhaps until we'll see. But
March
or so. Just given the gravity of it and the motion, that would be helpful. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Thanks,
Janet.
Thank you.
Jim, you voted yes also?
Yes.
And for the record, John was not asleep. I was just kidding.
I don't know. Sleep.
Well, thank you all. I have to be going. I have an exam.
Good luck, Tremaine.
Thank you.
Good grade. Give him a waiver.
Thank you. Happy holidays to everyone.
Same to you.
Thank you, Trey.
It's the season. The next item on the agenda is the implementation of the strategic plan. This is pretty darn exciting. Last time I spoke to you about this was in, I believe, February of last year. We had just launched it. I had a wonderful video for you and your very own copy of the strategic plan, the Cliff Notes size. If you want to see the full Monty, as I call it, it's posted on the web, and I've given you the link at the top of the handout.
just a quick recap. At that time, we had...
It's an awful visual.
We had concluded about a year-and-a-half process, very participatory across the campus, over 200, 300 faculty, staff, students, and alumni participated, and came up with a strategic plan to span a 5 to 7 year time frame that included 6 goals, one, undergraduate education, 2, student experience, 3, graduate education, 4, research, 5, infrastructure, and 6, community and alumni engagement. Each of those, of course, had 6 sub-goals and many objectives, all of which needed to be done yesterday. And so the president selected a small subset for a first-up priority. And in the handout that was sent to you and is in your folders are the implementation for years 1 and 2. And let me just tell you a little bit about each of those and talk about the overall implementation plan. Implementation plan, as you might guess, can't include everything all at once, so we chose priority areas. There are 7 priority areas. It also entails the implementation of a plan, the alignment of the campus individual units' priorities lining up with the larger university priorities. So we have both central implementation plans as well as what I call contribution plans on the part of all of the units on the campus. The implementation plans, the groups here, are clusters of objectives and goals that were pulled out as considered to be the things that needed to be addressed first, the most important things for first consideration. Each of these has a working group assigned to it, and I'll say a little bit more about them. The first area is undergraduate academics. This area focuses on improving the experience in the major and the minor, improving the writing program, the general education program, as well as the international components of the undergraduate experience. There's a number of other pieces to this, but those are the highlights of it. You'll see on this first page, as you look at it, that there are little globes next to some items, for instance, international and engagement. Those little globes indicate areas in which our strategic plan aligns with the SUNY strategic plan. Always important to keep in focus. So first up is the undergraduate academics. The second area is student engagement, advising, mentoring, and support. This one focuses on both advisement and mentoring, as well as the support services like career development and other areas that provide for the student experience to be as rich in the co-curricular areas as it is in the curricular areas. Also included in this area is an engagement. We call it the student alumni objective, being an active leader in community building to improve the quality of life in the region. The third area is student recruitment and enrollment. This area is one in which we look to both improve the profile of our incoming students as well as broaden the access for the campus to perhaps populations that aren't traditionally served by us. So some interesting new implications for enrollment. The fourth is graduate education. In this one, the focus is on developing better program evaluation processes by which we evaluate our graduate programs and then applying those principles to the resource allocation picture in graduate education. We also hope to attract and retain ever better groups of graduate students. Fifth area is research. In this one, we seek to increase our scholarly and creative output, as well as improve our administrative support for post-award services. Sixth is keeping pace with emerging technologies, always a rough thing to keep up with. And sixth, I call is cross-cutting the faculty and instructional development, the things that we need to do for our faculty and staff on campus so that they can do the other things that we're asking them to do. So this one focuses not only on the engagement of full-time faculty with the instructional mission, but also the areas of hiring and retention and other areas where we've looked to promote the faculty satisfaction and staff retention on campus across the entire university. These are the folks who are, of course, actually implementing the university's mission. So those 7 areas have been populated by working groups, co-chairs, as well as students, faculty, and staff across the university. And they are now at work focusing on those different areas. We also have a larger strategic planning implementation steering committee, which is on the next page of your document. And that one, its task is to make sure that this keeps on going. So the task of the steering committee is to develop an evaluation plan. We've got that underway, to conduct the evaluation, to monitor progress, to make sure that the working groups continue on their process, and to advise the president with any kind of adjustments that we need. The names of the steering committee members are at the bottom. The tasks of the working groups, again, are on the next section. Their task is to essentially put the plan in motion. And the final page is a timeline of where we are from the beginning of last summer through the first year, in which you'll see that the president has called for their contribution plans across campus to be submitted. Those will also get coalesced. So by roughly June of next year, we'll have a sense of how we've done for year one. We'll have a sense of the contributions of each of the units, and we'll make whatever mid-course corrections we need to make for going into year two. Dan, you're looking at me like you have a question.
No. I think it's always fascinating to think about how you go from the aspirational to the actual execution, and that's I'm just listening to your process. And I know that I was just curious how that works and how it's informed and how you go back and gauge yourself, because we've seen a lot of great strategic plans.
Sit on the shelves.
Well, no. I mean, yeah, obviously. And then so I was, as you know, these are all great goals, and I was listening to you intently, probably maybe too intently. That's what I was just curious about, just that piece of it.
Yeah. It's one of the things that we've done in designing the working groups is that we included both some people who had been on the strategic planning committee, so they were involved in the formation of the ideas, and also some new blood, new brains, new people who hadn't been involved before. So that has entailed, it has brought to the working groups some of the wisdom and vision, and also some new perspectives that might have thought of something a little different. I wouldn't say that the Strategic Planning Committee had all the good ideas, maybe just most of them. So we have both the opportunity for some new thinking of, well, maybe we could implement it in this way rather than that. This might make sense. Have you thought about that? So the first part of this period of time, the groups probably got underway. They were finally formed probably in August, beginning of September. So they spent probably a month and a half, maybe 2 months, making sure everybody knows the same amount. And now they're into let's find best practices, let's figure out how we're going to implement it, here are the action steps that we need to take, and here's how we will know when we're getting there. We just had a conversation yesterday about the process of tracking it, of making sure that we know we keep goal-focused, but don't squelch any creativity that may evolve in the process. So I'm hoping to try to manage it so that it continues to progress. And I can always already see progress. So you've heard about the Gen Ed proposal that will be on the table, we hope, in the spring. That's been pushed along. The writing proposal will be actually part of that. We've got some other initiatives that we're looking to build a peer mentoring program that will provide some of the mentoring. So there are already some pieces that are bubbling up. There's lots of enthusiasm on it with the working groups. And I'm quite sure that we won't have done all of these things by the end of year one, but we will have done a good chunk of them, and we'll do a mid-course correction and see what we pick up and sprint another 12 months before we sort of take a deep breath, see where we are for the next couple of years.
Great.
Yeah.
Thank you, Sue. Anybody have questions?
So to what extent are these goals driving resource allocation?
They're constantly asking me this. As we went through the budget process last year, strategic plan was being developed, I'm mentally stashing away money that I know is going to be needed to implement a strategic plan. We also have the benefit in this, by starting the strategic plan now, of the new UAlbany impact income that will also be able to be directed towards the strategic goals. As it happens, which is very fortunate, our strategic plan informed UAlbany impact, which informed the budget, which now informs the reallocation process. So we've got this lined up. There's also another fortuitous circumstance. We also have facilities in this mix as well. The facilities master plan process, a once every decade process that usually focuses on maintenance, critical maintenance and repair, this time focuses on planning for the UAlbany of the future. So what is things going to look like over the next 10, 25 years? It began, that process began roughly a year ago, and our work on the strategic plan, our work on the UAlbany Impact New York City 2020 plan coalesced with that so that the facilities master plan process is also now in line with the strategic plan and the UAlbany impact plan. So far we've got all the ducks in a row.
Master plan is going to be submitted in January, so we are we've gotten it right through
in sequence. Part of that?
Always complaining, always complaining.
You know, as a member of one of the working
that's
units,
where the money's coming from.
As a member of one of the working groups on emerging technologies, I can attest to the fact that, I mean, facilities is there, online courses are being discussed, new technologies are being discussed, and there really is an enthusiasm. And it really is tying together the strategic plan and going forward, and the comments from middle states and all the other stuff are really coming together in these working groups.
One thing that though that strikes me is listening to Kay's script, and you know the engagement mentoring part that's going on here, and you're sort of pushing this effort to engage alumni in mentoring. And I know there's certain things we have going on over at the School of Business doing the same thing, and I notice it's here, but is there? Are those groups all talking to each other? I mean, I guess that's my. Maybe we should be.
Yeah, we should.
Team up.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, as I listen to across the university to the plans that are being made for greater engagement and drawing in what I'll call our two new workforces. We have two new workforces available. We used to just have faculty and staff.
Right.
Now we have alumni and students. and
true.
Remarkably wonderful, enthusiastic, energized new participants in the workforce that if we are organized and welcoming and
she's going to come up with 1,200 people for
right.
you.
She's going to come
up with
1,200
people. That's what
I heard,
right?
Oh, wow. I've got a whole new workforce here. So I think those initiatives, when we have thought about the kinds of things that we're able to do on campus, we often think of ourselves as limited to the those who are currently on our payroll, and don't realize that we have resources in the community, in our student body, in our alumni,
yeah.
In our council. I'll be knocking on your door.
That's great.
So it's really a broadening of what we have to work with, and very exciting people who are very interested.
I mean, even listening to Tremaine talk about the challenges at the Student Association and thinking about the
right.
broad experience you guys
right.
have that you could lend to them to help put in controls, procedures, it seems to me that's sort of begging for some mm-hmm. real life experience
yeah.
to step in
exactly.
and say, we've been there, we can help.
We actually, a number of years ago, Dan will remember this.
I do, yeah.
We actually put the Student Association under a form of receivership by the council, because we are responsible at the end of the day for the Student Association, and they had some accounting issues.
Irregularities.
Yeah, we're churning out accountants, you know, by the armful.
This group of kids is so incredibly engaged. You know, we named October Community Engagement Month. Much of the programming, much of the planning, much of the activities, including meetings with the mayor and a number of other constituent groups, was orchestrated by the students. I mean, we attended, we had people there, but the students generated the activity, and it was, I mean, these kids are great. That's what always drives me crazy when we have an isolated incident that involves one or two students that, you know, taints the rest of them, because these are great young people that will be tremendous contributors to our society when they graduate, and are today.
Well, that's great. I mean, I really do think somebody should circle back and offer up that help to those guys.
I will even speak to somebody at the school of business, because we've got their training. I mean, literally, right. Training. They have both accounting training, obviously, and regulatory programs.
Audit, I mean, yeah, audit control and all the
all of those things. Yeah, exactly.
I said it
right here.
I
mean, it'd be good for the students over there to get
on the thesis involved. Presentations for some of our business students. If you want to have, especially those of you who understand the investment community in Wall Street, just if you really want to get a treat, sit in on some of these presentations that these young people make. And I will tell you that I once considered myself very good at what I did, but there's no way in heck when I was 21 years old that I had any level, anywhere near the level of sophistication and knowledge that these young people have. It's incredible what they know and how they can relate to the general community. It's tremendous. They're really bright young people.
Yeah. That's great. Thanks, Sue. That's wonderful. Great work. Kathy?
Yeah, I just need to log into the computer.
Real life projects where you could easily
exactly. Wire, whatever. Yeah, right. A great module will come on.
Right.
Did
you oh, yeah, oh, no, I got it.
Yeah, you
will
see
that
right. I know.
Good things.
I used to tell students that about myself.
Okay. Thank you, Kathy.
Okay, I just want to talk to you a little bit about university's mobile strategy, particularly as it relates to the university's website. As you know, the website is one of the most important communications and marketing tools of the university, and mobile technology is really impacting the way we do our business now, both internally and how people interact with us. Recent Pew Internet study tells us that smartphone users comprise 58% of Americans ages 25 to 34, and as of college-age students, 49% use smartphones. And 68% of those people go online on a typical day. So about one quarter of the smartphone population use it as a main source for internet access. That being said, at the University of Albany, just when you talk about our overall website visits and what the type of traffic that is coming to us, in the past year, January to November, we had over 11.2 million visits to the website. That's not unique visitors. That would be 4 million unique visitors, which contributed to 11.2 million visits. Page views, that added up to 43.4 million page views. So 40.3 million people, or times people came to a site on our page on our website. There was a 6.7% increase of visitors on our website from 2010 to 2011. So the point being that web traffic continues to grow fairly rapidly. We have about 500,000 of the visits to our website come from mobile users. And this graph really is just to show how much mobile platform use is increasing over from one year over the next. The platforms from which people come to us from, you can see from the first quarter in 2010 to the third quarter in 2011, it's growing exponentially. Primarily, people are coming to us through iPhone. After that, they come through Droid, a little bit from BlackBerry, and iPad's growing. You can see iPad didn't even exist back here. But iPad is taking us by storm. In May, they introduced the iPad, the new iPad, and sales went up, and so did the traffic to our website via that platform.
Wow.
Rob's running up the numbers
This reinforces that last graph where you can see that the iPad, nothing, and it, you know, now it's about 15% of that to our website, and the iPhone contributes to the greatest traffic. When they use the mobile technology, where are they coming? They're coming to MyU Albany, which, for those of you who aren't familiar with that, that's our university portal page, which requires a login. So that implies that those are internal users, right, people who come there to use to get things like Blackboard, which is, you know, course schedules, registration, that type of thing. Then after that, they're coming to the home page, and these are all internal things. But if you get down to 9 and 10, they're coming to academics and the admissions homepage. So within the top 10 pages, mobile people are coming to academics and admissions, and that implies they're external users because they're looking at our school as a potential place to attend.
Where does athletics fall on that?
Athletics falls within the
is that because, I mean, for example, when I log on, I don't usually go on to athletics. I usually go on to the home page and then just hit athletics. So does that mean you're only going on the home page?
No. This is where they first come to.
Yeah. So athletics then would probably never necessarily be in the top because
you get a separate hit, right? You register if you go to athletics.
Correct.
Well, no, you wouldn't. You'd be hitting athletics once you're on the homepage.
I guess that's a question.
Navigate to is what you're saying.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
We have all that literature too, but for the sake of this presentation, I'm trying to give numbers as to the top things. You know.
But if you also visit the homepage and then he goes to the athletic page, you count both, right?
We have numbers about how many people visit the athletics page and where they come from to get there.
Okay.
So 75% of UAlbany students have smartphones, and what this is driving, what's happening here is not only the students who have the smartphones, but prospective students, what they all want are there's this huge rush to get apps. Does everyone know what an app is on your smartphone? Okay. Universities across the nation were just scrambling to try to figure out, well, what kind of app should we have? For example, a lot of people are coming to us saying, do you have an athletics app? Do you have one to get for maps, to get to a map to your university? And what we were discovering is that maps have a host of problems that, as far as an institution goes, and organizationally, human resources, and financial. They're expensive. You have to develop them for the various platforms. So if you develop an app that is iPhone friendly, it may not be Droid friendly. And so it's just because you develop one doesn't mean you've solved all your problems. They're expensive to maintain. You have to have when you have your phone, it update your apps. Well, you have to keep updating them. You become a slave to technology to keep updating these. And then within 20 days, most apps, 90%, are no longer used. They have a short shelf life because most people want apps that have that can do transactions. You want to be able to transfer money out of your account from your checking to your savings. You want to be able to register for a class. We need apps that have value if you're going to invest in doing them. A recent article in the Chronicle of Higher Education, which I believe is in your packets, tells us that we were relieved to discover that as these mobile devices are multiplying, that the schools that rushed out and developed apps for their colleges finally just gave up. They realized that they couldn't keep up with the pace of technology. They couldn't keep doing the updates on them. So the direction that campuses are turning to are doing mobile-specific websites, which means that you're analyzing what are the pages that people most want to go to, what type of transaction do they want to make, and we're making those pages on our website mobile friendly. And so I'm happy to say that that's what we are doing.
Can I ask a question, just semantic? So mobile friendly versus an app, I don't understand. Was it semantics or what do you?
Yeah, well, you would have, say you navigate to a site, on a website. If it's not mobile friendly, you're going to see like one big thing of text. You can't read the whole page. You have to scroll around.
Right. Okay.
An application is designed for a smartphone.
Right.
When you get there, you can see everything on one screen.
Gotcha.
It's all compact.
And that's the coding that spends. It's more money, another process, and you
can't. Yeah,
it's
a whole different writing.
Okay.
You have to write for that, for the technology, because you can't write big long sentences.
A mobile friendly website is different than an app. That means
you're
accessing it through the internet rather than accessing it from the app.
Correct.
Maybe that's
right. And I'll show you an example.
I have one of these things. I still don't understand how it works.
I have pictures for you of that.
Okay.
Good. We can handle pictures.
So what are we doing? We've gone around and we've done an analysis of, first of all, we surveyed current students. What types of things are they looking for? They want Blackboard, webmail, class schedule, that type of thing. And from that information, we are proceeding with our plan to do our mobile site. And we have already done all the low-hanging fruit. So, again, we're building a mobile optimized website. And this resides on a different domain. So it's not, if you come to our site via your smartphone, it's going to ask you if you want. Oh, which Andy just did. And what's the language it says?
Oh, it said stay on the full website or use the mobile app.
Use the mobile. So you have the option.
And the mobile's in purple and the stay on the main website's in gold. So there you go.
Right. So if you go to our website now, if you get on your smartphone, this is what you're going to see. And we devised this. This is sort of our first phase. This is our first leap into mobile technology. These were all from the surveys, this is what people told us they wanted. So we went here first. We don't have a lot of transactional stuff yet because that costs time, money, and technology, and we're everything is different. I mean, if you want to register for classes, that's a different company. So it's very complex, and that's what we're sorting through right now.
You can't make donations on this, on the mobile app.
And they are,
yes, you can. Actually, we have a QR code too, and you can put it against the envelopes, and it will take you directly to our.
And the good news about that is because they use an outside vendor to create so that already exists.
Oh, I see. All right.
So those are the types of things that we're sorting for.
I need to get his hands in your pocket.
Anyway you can, right?
So, for example, on this, people say they want, maps and directions. So if you go to our maps now, we're now on Google Maps, which is a nice thing. It used to be this one big map and the updates. We're still working out the kinks on this. It's not perfect, but it is. Like, for example, we don't know why, but I think if you click on this little graduation cap there, it takes you to the Turkish Student Association, and we don't know why. So the other thing is we have, this building is really our university administration building, but if you click on university administration building, it takes you to the old administration building over there, which we need to change the name, Steve, on the old administration building because it's screwing up our Google Maps. but anyway, if you go back to the main navigation and you clicked on...
Cool.
News, you would take us to a news center, et cetera, et cetera. So anyway, we just launched this last month, so we feel like we're making some good progress in this area. So now that we have this mobile site, we're starting to get some data in about where people are going when they use it. And the top place they go is to the home page. And we were surprised to see that within the top 10, they go to our graduate programs. Mobile users are going to our graduate programs, so that's very interesting to us. So these are this is the type of thing that we're going to be able to monitor and pay attention to as we go along. It will inform us as we develop the content on the site. In summary, mobile technology is having significant impact on our communications office, on what we need to do. We are trying to figure out quickly how to write for mobile, because we have to write two versions instead of one. And just when we thought we had a handle on the web, along came mobile, and we're everyone's scrambling to try to get their heads around it. So, any questions?
Better you than me.
Thank you, Kathy.
Thank you.
That's great. Go where?
There,
oh, okay.
There was an interesting statement you made.
If you're in the supermarket, don't be embarrassed to pick up a copy of Women's World, because on page 26 is a story about the university spoiler officer, Freedom of Information Law, who actually is in my office, and she does a lot of volunteerism. She was a vet, and she does a lot for the community, and so there's a story about one of our employees in Women's World.
Pick it up, get in the long line.
Fardine, do you need to go next, or can we stick with Pierre?
No, I just wanted to set something up.
Okay, sorry. Great, no problem. Pierre, ACT.
Sure, thank you. Last council meeting was the day before our annual conference, which was held in Cooperstown. It was the largest conference and represented the most campuses in quite a while. Mike joined as the member of the board of directors for ACT. The conference subject was shared services and college council roles and responsibilities. At the particular time, there was a lot of debate and lively discussion on shared presidents, which seems to have passed with some of the new resolutions adopted by the SUNY Board of Trustees and the agreement at Canton and Potsdam. But shared services continues to be a hot topic. As president of ACT, I will join, the chancellor's asked that I join the steering committee for shared services, which is being formulated now, and our provost is also on that steering committee. So we look forward to seeing how that progresses. We also have a governance committee for ACT, and we'll be discussing some of the presidential search guidelines, some of the roles and responsibilities of councils. We will be meeting shortly with the new chair, Carl McCall, to discuss that that initiative. And January 9th, the chancellor will present her second annual State of the University message. ACT has hosted the luncheon following that address. I know that a number of council members here attended last year. An invitation will go out, and we would hope that those that would be interested in attending would attend. It'll be at the Egg following her address, so, and we'll keep everybody posted on that. And Michael will be featured as he presented the award-winning student from Albany. Maybe you'd like to say something about Sam and the scholarship luncheon.
What do I have? I'm trying to remember what I know about Sam. It was a great opportunity. It was all about service, and this kid was incredibly impressive. I don't remember the specifics necessarily. He's from Ithaca, New York. Right. I do remember that. I met the whole family. Sat with
the police, the selection.
That's right. Thank you. He was actively involved in the as a student representative on the selection for the City of Albany police chief. And I thought that was particularly important in light of some of the issues that we've had that George had alluded to earlier. And just a very impressive kid, I got to say. I really enjoyed it. I mean, I'd not met him before, obviously. We sat with him for lunch. And just an impressive kid and an impressive family, to tell you the truth. His brother was there, older brother, and his mom. And I was great. I was one of the best things I've ever done as a member of this council, I got to say. It really was enjoyable.
We were well represented in that search. Alan Lozat was also on that search. You know, from the chief happens to be the one.
Oh, really?
No problem.
Great.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Thanks, Pierre. Thank you, Michael. Fardine?
Thank you. About 4 weeks ago, we received a call from a parent who is serving in Afghanistan, wanted to know if we webcast our commencement ceremony. Unfortunately, we don't have the capacity to do so, but kudos to the wonderful team in the events office who managed the commencement. They just could not let this go because they were very disappointed. They started thinking, and they come up with an idea of contacting the father so he will write a letter. So as they were doing all of these things, they decided, well, they have to do also something to show him what happened. So there's a video clip that of the, how everything came about. The first person that is talking is James Hyde, who was the genius behind the whole thing.
That's awesome.
I don't know how to turn the volume up here. Here it is.
Where are the acoustics coming from?
It's coming from the computer. Is there anything under the box there?
Here.
Underneath the...
This is the young lady.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I replay.
Kudos really to the events team, and because when they came to me, I was like, oh, I'm sorry, you just didn't know what to do. So I think they do a great job, and George commented how wonderful the commencement was. But there's so much behind the scene that I don't see, we don't see. So I thought it was important for all of you to see this.
Pardon me, incidentally, is instrumental. I mentioned earlier that we're one of the few schools that has a winter commencement. Well, frankly, that was on the chopping block when we had all of the budget cuts. And Pardeen and the foundation actually saved it from the chopping block, largely. So
thank you.
It's to their great credit.
As far as the fundraising initiatives, we are 37% ahead of last year. But as I always say, this is about timing of the gifts. So we received some very large gifts in the second half of last year. And if you go apple to apples, we are about 7 or 6% ahead of last year at this time. And last year was a high water mark for us. We were about $12.5 million, and I hope we could reach the same number. We received a $200,000 gift from Second Chance Scholarship Fund, and that was an organization that the foundation decided to get out of being a foundation anymore. So. The gifts went to four different SUNY campuses, and our foundation was instrumental to drafting the MOU for all the other campuses. And our foundation is going to be matching from now on $10,000 to $15,000 a year to subsidize that endowment fund. That was part of our agreement. But other foundations like the Hudson Valley Community College, because of their capacity, they're only doing $2,000 to $3,000 a year. Last year, I showed you a video of You Albany Unite, if you recall, and I'm glad to say that we're receiving a national award for it at the CASE conference in New York City on January 19th. That's again, you know, it was my team. I think they do a great job. And one initiative that is in line with what Kate and the alumni, Kate Hotelling was saying about the Alumni Association. and with Ward did an incredible job. I don't know why she gives me and the team credit for helping with them, because you know you guys do incredible work in helping us in all matters. We noticed about, so one of our greatest challenges is getting the doors open to some of our most wonderful prospects out there who are yet to be donors, or and the reason is they have no engagement with university. Even though we have been trying for years and years through some of our best development officers, presidents, vice presidents, the deans, the doors are just not open to us. And if some of you have worked with my development officers, you know how good they are, whether it's Bill Roller or it's Mary Johnson or Michael Boots. They're very good, but we just couldn't get anywhere. About 8 years ago, Georgetown University started a program, and it's called, they use the students to go and meet with these prospects that have limited engagement with the university. In our case, it's no engagement with the university. These are very, very high-level prospects. So we identified 65 very high-level prospects that we have never, ever been able to connect in any shape or form or any way possible. And this is not, and our approach wasn't going to be about fundraising, and it is not going to be about fundraising. George wrote a letter to these prospects and saying, explaining the project, and we trained 12 students to go and meet with these prospects and interview them for an hour. No written notes or nothing. And just talk about them, about how they got to be where they are in their life, and their experience at the university. And in the letter, George did mention that there will be no fundraising. That's not what it is. Our hope was from the 66 people, if we get two interviews, that would be great. And the interviews will be done through the intercession when the students, we identified New York City and Greenwich area as our target market. If we get two interviews, it would be great. And the students would call from their own cell phones. The students have already been trained, and also they have done some mock interviews. Students didn't know this was a mock interview. We sent them to some of the alumni that we already, you know, told them about the project. So if there was any, so we knew how the students were going to be performing. We have over 11 interviews so far, and these are going to be done. 11 interviews during the intercession. That's when it's going to be done, and each student is going to get paid $100 plus expenses per interview. So it has been very, very successful. Now, outside of Georgetown, there is about 200 other institutions that do it. So we work with them. So this is the best practice going forward. And that is my report.
So those 66, none of them are existing donors?
No. We have no, definitely they're not donors. They have never answered a call, came to an event, or
many of them have told us not to bother them.
Yes, right. Many of them told us.
They're on the do not call list.
Yeah, so.
That's great.
That's good. Thank you.
Thanks, Freddie. Great work, as always. Thank really you. Inspiring. Okay, we have a last item on the agenda is the presidential search. So, a couple things. We are formally announcing the presidential search today. There's a presidential search announcement that will go out this evening after the meeting. There's a copy of that. That each of you have received in your package today. I think it's fairly pro forma in the sense that it just sort of commences the process, goes through some of the statutory highlights and requirements and the protocols as we go forward here. What I asked Amy Bernstein, who's here with us today, Amy is works for the city administration. She is going to be and has worked with us in the past on presidential searches, is very familiar not only with the search process, obviously, but with the University at Albany itself. Has a lot of familiarity with a lot of the people in the room and a lot of the folks on campus. She's just a wonderful person here. And we're very fortunate to have her assigned to work with us again in this search. And while, you know, it's a really, it's it's hard for any of us to think about life without George, although having him here, it's...
I'm hiding in the corner.
I know, I already see. He's already retreating to the corner. But, I mean, this is an exciting next step in the university's development. It's a very important next step. There are a lot of critical elements that will transpire in the near, intermediate, and long term. And I thought what would be helpful today is just to have Amy, who's had the benefit of two very recent searches as well, both at Buffalo and Binghamton, go over big picture of the process, protocols, some of the expectations around how this works. And Amy, anything else that you want to fill in for us?
Thanks, Dan, and thank you for having me. I'm sure it's not great when people see me come around because it just means another search is underway. But George tells us it's something we have to do, so we're moving forward with this. So I am, just so everybody knows, an associate vice chancellor. Work out of the chancellor's office, provost's office now. And I will be the liaison to the search from the chancellor's office. So as you all know, the search is the province of the council. So this is, you know, just a preliminary start. Where, you know, the first step is really to start talking about it, and that's what we're doing here. So what we've handed out is our current guidelines. You may have heard that there are changes afoot. However, they have not taken effect as of yet. So we are working from these, and if they come into place during, I've gotten those kind of questions. It won't really affect how we move along with the search. You know, it will go very similarly to the searches that have happened in the past here at Albany and also at Stony Brook, Buffalo, University of Buffalo, and at Binghamton. The good news is that we just did complete a search at Binghamton, and it was actually a very good search, really great interest, very high-level candidates, which is to say that there's good feeling out there about SUNY, and I think, you know, we really do have a lot of recognition now, and, you know, I suspect that the search will go very well. The campus is in a good place. Much more stability now than, you know, last time around, both at the state level, the SUNY system level, the campus level. So I really suspect that this will be a very successful, difficult search because we're really have a wonderful leader to replace here. But I do suspect it will all go very well. The other good news is that there are a lot of people who have gone through this process, not, you know, in the not too distant future past. So you know, people are familiar with the process. The process really, you know, is the same. So having said that, you know, the first step is to put together a search committee. I've had conversations with Susanna Fessler to start their faculty piece, and they're going to get on board with that. The rest is, you know, the council will take the motions to get all the other constituency groups on board to pick their representatives, so we're moving forward with that. Parallel to that process will be the signing on and the process to get a search consultant on board too, which is we'll go through the regular RFP process to get a search consultant, which again is a council job to do, and that will those will be the next steps. Given that what I've heard from the faculty and the process that they have to go through, it gives us some time. So what I suspect is that once all our ducks are in row with all the elections that have to take place around campus, you know, we are probably looking at February for a first meeting of the search committee. So that sort of puts us at a start date, and then we go from there. And at that point, we hope to have the search consultant on board as well. And then it takes off from there. So I don't know, you know, the the process is the same. I could go into more detail if you'd like. It's a little premature at this point. I mean, you know, we're really at the very, very beginning stages of it. I'm happy to answer any questions, but we are doing what we should be doing at this point, sort of getting all our ducks in a row. And as the chancellor's liaison, I'm having the conversations with all the people that really need to be contacted and moving things forward.
Amy, can I ask a question I asked you already, but I wanted to address to the whole council. In our last, from what I understand, in our last presidential search, it wasn't just the teaching faculty that the Senate was responsible for finding for the search committee. It was also that one position that's reserved for professional faculty. And our campus is a little bit different than most other city campuses in that respect, so the guidelines don't really help us there. So I'd like the council to let me know if the Senate is responsible for finding that professional faculty member in addition to the six teaching faculty members for the search committee.
Right. And if I can, I mean, Susan and I had that conversation, and what I said is those are decisions that the council will get back to her, you know, as we move down that path on picking the representatives to sit on the search committee. It is not usual throughout the system for the faculty senate to choose that. That will be a council decision on how to move forward.
I just wanted clarification on
right.
what I need to provide in terms of bodies for that
right.
committee. And let me also put specific dates that we already talked about earlier on that. The first Senate meeting of the spring semester is February 6th. We still haven't met for our last meeting this semester, but our last meeting for this semester is next Monday. So there's no way we could pull all that together by next Monday for an election. And so this is why Amy was looking at early February as having all the committee members together. There's more than just that election that has to happen before then. The ballot has to be put together. There'll be a couple different Senate Executive Committee meetings to get all that in place. So my hope is that we'll have the election in the Senate meeting, which will have a quorum by hook or by crook on February 6th. Maybe I'll bring cookies. And then I'm planning on calling a special meeting of the Senate Executive Committee 2 days after that so that the final group of six, list of six teaching faculty for the search committee can be forwarded.
Fair enough.
So if I could, you know, just clarify, so, you know, the search committee consists of, and I put this out, you know, with really the caveat that these are our guidelines. You know, each campus is different, and, you know, you'll see if you look at searches at the different campuses, there is some flexibility, and, you know, but the guidelines set out that there are, the search committee shall consist of four members of the council, including the chair, so there are five total. Six members of the full-time teaching faculty of the campus, one student, one alumni representative, one campus-related foundation representative, one academic dean, one professional or support staff member. So the council will, my understanding, and Dan can talk about this, but notify those members on campus of representatives that will be needed to the search.
Right. I mean, we will be after this meeting calling for nominations from each of those constituent groups to present nominees. And Sorrel, I think you're in shape to do that, right?
Mm-hmm. Not tomorrow. But
no, I mean,
yes.
have a bourbon and do it tonight. Yeah. But no. But I think we have talked about that, and certainly, absolutely. And our goal and objective, obviously, is to have a very representative and diverse committee. I think we've strove for that in the past. We've achieved that in the past. Making sure that all the appropriate voices are part of the process is very critical. Obviously, you know, there are some statutory requirements, and there's some flexibility how we build that out, and we'll be working to do that in the very near future. So, Suzanne, I know we need to get back to you on that piece, and we will.
The one other thing that there is a change from the last time is that the chancellor has been attending the first search committee meetings. So we will arrange to have her, whether, I mean, this is easy. You know, I generally say in person or on phone or on video, but given that it's in Albany, I'm sure she'll be here to do it. And she will present a charge to the committee, you know, a written charge, and everything will be put up on the website. And I know that the council wants a truly transparent search, and we will all strive to do it that way.
Great. Thanks, Amy.
Now, if we start in February, when can we expect to have somebody in place?
Well, you know, I think it's really, you know, a search consultant will dictate that a little bit. You know, if we're able to start, you know, I think realistically it won't happen until mid-February if the faculty is not going to get the representatives till the first week. So if we're looking at, let's say, February 15th, I think it's, I think we could really look to having, you know, first interviews by April, you know, second interviews by, you know, May. That's, you know, under best circumstances.
Right. I mean, Abner, obviously the goal would be to have a new president in place for the next academic year,
right.
And that's clearly something
so
we want to have a
that's
process
what the goal
that
would
puts
be.
Pretty
and
aggressive.
And I think
though,
we're within that window where we can get it done.
Okay.
Right. I mean, you know, it will be with the understanding of everybody, of all members of the search committee, that, you know, they may need to, you know, be here when other people are not, and really, you know, with the understanding that their participation is mandatory for all meetings. So
it can't be done if you're not here for all meetings. I mean, it's a significant commitment, as a lot of people in this room can attest to, and it's a very worthwhile commitment and rewarding commitment. But it is very time-consuming, and you have to have a significant amount of flexibility, too, because things change, whether you can just see, even listening to Susanna, you have to be able to adapt to a flexible schedule. I do think we will do our best to take advantage of technology, and maybe we'll have to get Kathy Herman back to just figure out what's the best way to do that. But
Skype.
You know, as far as perhaps looking at some meetings in New York, if that's necessary, just trying to work with the ultimate committee composition, you know, where perhaps we some of the candidates are. It's just we're going to have some flexibility, but I can't stress enough that it's not going to work unless you're 100% committed to the process. Any other questions for Amy? Okay, I mean, I guess I would say from my standpoint, we will obviously be looking to constitute a subcommittee of the council to work on the search process. Really, we're going to have an RFP go out to the pre-approved or the existing panel of qualified search firms that the university uses for presidential searches. You know, from that pool, we can shortlist and interview firms. Is there a protocol on how many firms we have to interview, or what's the, as far as the search process itself for the search?
No.
So,
We do need to actually interview we have to give everybody an opportunity to be interviewed.
Correct. Okay.
So everybody who, submits a proposal,
Have
to give the opportunity.
Right, so we'll reach out to...
So they have to submit a proposal first.
They have to submit
all
a proposal.
All 10, and then we'll see who submits proposals, right? Okay.
You won't get 10 proposals.
No, we won't get 10 proposals. Some of them are only designated community colleges.
Right.
Some just won't have the time to do it. So we send out the request, RFP, for all 10, and, you know, we'll probably get them 7. And we give them each 7 an opportunity to interview. Not they all won't take it. And the interview could be phone, video, in person.
Right. When will the that RFP process commence?
Well, I would like to do it Monday. Start talking.
Do you need a resolution to move that, or can we just, as a group, just go forward?
Just go forward.
Okay. Okay.
Dan, it would be helpful to the Senate, I think, if when I put out a call for nominations for the search committee, I can in some way quantify what the commitment is.
That's a good idea.
Apropos of what you were just saying. There are people who will throw their hat in the ring and then they say, oh, I didn't know.
Yeah, that's a great point, Susanna, and we have some descriptions and timelines, and one of the things, you know, we will get out, I think, Amy, after this is
not just a timeline, but it's sort of a description of the commitment to the process and, you know, how time, you know, I'm sure you have a format for this already. We have one from the last process I looked at. I actually thought it was pretty good, but we'll look to turn that around and get that back, not just to you, but the other members of the council.
Yeah, as soon as possible would be good for me.
There's some good verbiage in this, too, just even pulling from here, you can actually see.
I can easily send you a timeline from the process from what Fredonia's, they're all very similar.
Yeah, it's time zero and we go from
there. So it's how many meetings a person has to come and how long each meeting is what you need. And I can easily give that to you.
An estimate of weekly hours that they're going to put in.
I can easily give that to you.
And probably when Sorrell looks to solicit nominations from the groups we're talking about, it'd probably be helpful to have that go out with it, just I would think, describing the process, the requirements, so it's not the same issue. So I would think that would be worth doing. Okay. Any other advice for us, Amy?
I can't enjoy the holidays.
My advice is to expect somebody great. We'll all work to get just somebody great for all of them.
Okay. I mean, I think, look, we've sort of socialized this amongst ourselves. The last couple of weeks, there's been a lot of discussions about it. I think everybody recognizes the gravity and importance of the search process, and I can't speak to how fortunate we are to have had George serve as the president and put us in a position to get a next president who's going to be a tremendous asset for this university. Without the work that George has done, with all of his peers and colleagues, we wouldn't be in that position. I think we all recognize how challenging the last search process it is, and it's really a privilege, the position George has put us in to launch from here. And we get to create places by standing on the shoulders of great people before us. And George, you put us in a really lofty position here. Thank you for that, and this is not the time to sort of laud you, but yeah, there you go. So a lot of work to do. If there are any other questions or if people have them, certainly we can ask them now, but I think there's just a lot of hard work and commitment to follow here, and look forward to working with everybody. Thank you.
Here we go. I think the point you're making shouldn't be overlooked, and that is that had we had someone from the outside in George's time, it would be, I think, incredibly more difficult. But when you have to go through a very tough budget time, you have to cut people, you have to do all kinds of programs and so forth, if you have a new person in, it is very, very difficult for them to recover. But now, having put the university in this position, this is a good time to go forward. So I think that what you said is right on the money.
Well, it's an exciting time. And look, I mean, George will be the first to tell you, well, he's already committed to not leaving until we find a president, which is a dangerous commitment.
Based on our history,
right. But, I mean, George is going to be here. He's a great resource, and I know all of you, look to him. But, we get the benefit of George's wisdom and experience going forward here. And I think it's important as we think about the next president, having George here on the ground and continuing to serve as the president provides a tremendous amount of stability and confidence. And frankly, makes this job a lot easier. So we owe a huge debt of gratitude for George, not just for the service he's provided since he was a student. This guy has been committed to this place decade after decade, but for his willingness to continue to serve until we get the next president. And, it really makes our job that much easier. We can focus on finding the next president and not have to be concerned about the university itself. And then again, just George, can't thank you enough for that.
Absolutely.
Okay. And on that basis, all the staff and stuff, can I get a motion to adjourn?
Motion to adjourn.
All in favor? Who did it?
Stein always adjourns.
That's where I do best.
All right. All in favor?
Unless it's time to eat, then I'm even better at that.